Yankees Files Podcast. We are back. I'm Will Harris. You're Alec Whipple. And the rest of you are fans of a team that has not lost a series in 2023. Those New York Yankees, of course. Whipple, the Yankees took 2 of 3 from the Giants. They scored at least 5 runs in every game. They, Stanton and Judge are both popping off already. There's a lot to like with what we saw this weekend, I think. What have been your initial reactions to this season?
Yeah, I feel like popping off is a light way to describe a 485-foot batter's eye home run, which we correctly identified as something we had never seen before at Yankee Stadium. And they've been playing here for about 15 years now, so that was pretty crazy. Honestly, I think I would have said the starting pitching was the highlight, but that one home run might have stolen the weekend for me. Also, additional side note, I was not able to watch yesterday's game after the third inning. So in my mind, the 2023 New York Yankees have not given up a single run. And
that's pretty good.
I think that's pretty cool. I'm expecting that trend to continue. I think the small sample size is pretty indicative.
Yeah, I mean, especially doing it without Carlos Rodon or Luis Severino. This team is elite at run prevention. But really, I mean, to allow just 5 runs in the first 3 games, despite using every arm in the bullpen, despite getting a very short start out of Clark Schmidt, despite Johnny Brito making his major league debut, despite Colton Brewer making his Yankee debut, despite some uncharacteristic ineffectiveness from Mike King and Clay Holmes, like, for as much as we could overreact to certain aspects of certain pitching performances, the fact that the Yankees allowed just 5 runs across these 3 games, they're 2-1, they dealt 2 shutouts, one behind a kid who had never pitched in the majors before, it's hard not to feel really good. To win a 3-game series with a +9 run differential against a team that, like, is actually gonna win games this year. Like, this isn't what the Rays just did to the Tigers, who are just legitimately terrible. This is a real team with potentially a better offense than I, at least, was personally giving them credit for. I still think Jock should be a Yankee. I'm disappointed that he accepted the qualifying offer. It was just a lot of fun. So let's turn back the clock, if we can, to opening day. The Yankees ran Gerrit Cole out there, and last year, opening day started pretty badly for Gerrit Cole. The Red Sox got on him early, and ultimately the Yankees came back and won. But nothing of the sort this time. Cole, despite walking the first batter, then struck out, 6 of the next 7 batters he faced, or 8 of the next 9 batters he faced, something ridiculous. Basically put it in cruise control. Judge homered in his first plate appearance of the year. Gleyber hit a 2-run homer later. And then some hits strung together scored them a couple runs later in the game to cruise to a 5-0 victory. The Yankees, I think, had lost 7 of their last 11 on opening day going into Thursday's game. So a comfortable win was a welcome change.
Yeah, the team actually has turned around their opener streak. I remember going back like 5 years ago, they seemed to lose almost every year. And now last year they won, 2020, weird year they won. So they've definitely been better. You know, doesn't mean more than one game, but it's so nice to start off with an opening day win. I think last year,
especially with the off day following it.
Right. You get 48 hours of just, perfect baseball. And I would say that was pretty close to a perfect baseball game as I could imagine. I mean, last year's game was really exciting. It was a long game, a back and forth game, a lot of stress. This game was as stressless as I think you'll find in a baseball game. I mean, Gerrit Cole, tears coming out of my eyes as I watched him pound the upper half of the zone with fastballs. crying in the law school cafeteria. This is the stuff that Cy Young campaigns are made of. He was sharp. Like, there is another level for him. But it was so encouraging for him to just come out, backed by the Judge home run. He had that game, in command. It was pretty effortless. The tack on runs were nice, but, the minute Judge homered, it felt like this was the Yankees game to lose. And it was just awesome to have a stress-free opening day win, setting off on the right foot, and something that, the Yankees haven't really had. We can talk about Saturday's game, the emotions are running high, I think, early on. I think the way things ended last year, people are putting a lot of pressure on these early games. And, maybe if they had won Saturday, it would have been nice. The way they lost was pretty rough. But at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter. Like, the game, it doesn't matter. Last year, they started off, mediocre, and they came back to have a blazing hot start to get into April and May. But I think the takeaway is, these bigger things that you're looking at. Like you said, the starting rotation looks really good. The offense is scoring 5 runs a game. So it's nice to be able to not care as much. I think we would probably care more if they had lost today, even though it doesn't really matter. It's nice to be able to take the positives away from the loss. But, acknowledge that Thursday's win was as good as it gets for Gerrit Cole, Aaron Judge, Gleyber Torres, just guys who, some guys who really needed to have a hot start, some guys who, Aaron Judge doesn't really need to do anything at this point. the vibes were really good, and I think it kind of carried past a pretty up and down game, which ended up in a loss Saturday, and it carried into today. The opening day win sets a tone, whether you like it or not. So I think it was really good to see an easy, stress-free win.
And I've mentioned one guy who has made his major league debut this year in Johnny Brito, but I think I've kind of buried the lead. Whipple, we were dead wrong on how the Anthony Volpe saga would play out. And he has started at shortstop in every single game that the Yankees have played this year, which is, I think, has come as a surprise to us both. He's not setting the world on fire by any means, but he is getting on base at a .364 clip. He's stolen 3 bases. I don't know that he's hit a ball in the air more than about 250 feet, but we'll work on it. He is keeping Isaiah Kiner-Falefa away from shortstop, and that is one of the ultimate virtues. It's been great to see, I think, just the excitement around Anthony Volpe. I had some friends at the games on Thursday and Saturday, and they were just talking about how excited the crowd was for Volpe. And, he looks the part. He's made basically all the defensive plays you'd expect him to make, except for one on Saturday. He looks comfortable playing shortstop. He's competitive at the plate. He is taking his walks, which I think is very important. For a guy who's only 3 games into his major league career, he does not look out of place. And it would be very easy for him to have looked out of place. So I think there's a lot to be excited about there. That was kind of one of the more interesting storylines of this opening weekend, I think, was the Yankees gave this kid a chance, and he is, it'll be fun to watch and see if he capitalizes on it.
Yeah, this is something we were both dead wrong about. And even though I think we saw the tea leaves start to reveal what was going to happen, it was still really hard to believe that they were going to break with their mold of handling players and give him a chance. But at the end of the day, you really could not give him a chance. I mean, he was that good in spring training. And I think the only justification was based on our previous perceptions of how Brian Cashman operates. And at this point, it just seemed like so much was being handled differently. Like, the vibes were so different. It was nice to see that actually happen, for, not it to be baseless speculation, and for him to actually get the chance to play. And he's, like you said, he hasn't lit the world on fire, but I think his impact is being felt definitely in the field, definitely at the bottom of the lineup, where you can count on a quality at bat from your 9 hitter, when last year we sometimes couldn't count on quality at bats from our six hitter.
Yeah.
I think it just makes everything feel so much deeper. I think the inning that has stood out to me, and I know it really didn't matter much in today's game, was the seventh inning. I think Anthony Volpe set the tone in that inning and basically led him, you know, he was responsible for scoring one of the runs, but the way that he, I mean, just take, you know, you obviously watch, I'm sure most of you guys watch, but just for anyone who didn't get to watch, he drew a walk, then was dancing off of first, and Jelly, the pitcher, not Head Jelly, the really tall Giants pitcher.
Let's be clear about Jelly. First of all, he's 6'10". Second of all, he did not want to throw a strike to anyone.
No.
Like, at all. He did not want even to throw the ball to Blake Sable, the catcher.
Right.
He was not interested in, like, one of the main jobs, in my opinion, of the pitcher on a baseball team is to throw strikes. And I think he had gone to the Aroldis Chapman School of Strike Throwing, where they teach you not to do it.
It was not great. And I think Volpe, you know, his presence there was, you know, even, I mean, maybe he wasn't going to throw strikes anyway, but Volpe, the way he's dancing and hopping off of first base and is drawing throws, eventually leading to a wild pitch, Gleyber walks, and then leading to a double steal. You know, when are you, last year, our nine, you weren't having a 9-1 double steal from your leadoff and or number nine hitter and your leadoff hitter. The Yankees just didn't have that kind of speed. And really for Volpe, I mean, he's fast, but it's the intention for me. Like, he, every time he's on the base, he is looking for his opportunity. And that led to their fifth run, because Rizzo Sackfly wouldn't have been a run scoring productive out unless Volpe was on third. And then another wild pitch, Gleyber scores. So, like, some tack on runs that didn't mean anything, but wow, it was just really cool to see Volpe on base setting a different tone and, you know, being intentional with the way he's dancing off first, the way he's approaching steals, you know, really getting in the pitcher's head. We've seen it multiple times. It's just something now, you know, he's established it as something you have to think about. And so while the power has to come for sure, he's getting on base, and that's the important thing, because his best tool right now are his legs. And I think that's such a cool thing for, you know, a number nine hitter who's a rookie to be able to contribute at that pace pretty quickly. I mean, there are not many guys in Major League history who have stolen three bases in their first three games. Volpe is one of four, I believe the broadcast said. And nothing about the way he is approaching this makes me think, you know, stolen base number four won't come tomorrow night.
Can I convince you to enter a prediction of how many steals Anthony Volpe will finish the season with?
Sure. Do you want me to give a number, or you want to?
Oh, I want you to give a number.
Okay. Let's see. Well, it's not going to be 162, but it's probably more than I had thought. I'm going to say it gets to 50. Because I think I would have said 30, and now I'm thinking.
Really?
I mean, it's, again, like, he's fast, but nothing, like, if he wants to steal 50 bases, I mean, he has absolute control over that. I just have a hard time believing he wouldn't be able to.
So, man, 50 bases is a lot of bases. I see where you're coming from.
I mean, only 47 to go.
Only 47 to go. I see where you're coming from. I don't necessarily disagree that he could steal 50 bases if he wanted to steal 50 bases. But I think what it's important for us to remember is I don't think he's going to be hitting ninth all year. And I wonder if he's hitting
very fair point
at the top of the lineup, if he's hitting directly in front of Judge, for example. Are they going to want him attempting all these steals? Now, I will say, I think Major League Baseball probably made it too easy to steal bases. It's like, it's not at all clear to me that the success rate is going to end up like in the place where it should end up. And like, if that's the case, then maybe his success rate will continue to be so close to 100% that even if he is doing this during Judge or Rizzo or Stanton at bats, they're still going to be fine with it. But if he hits himself into the top of the order, I think they're going to stop giving him the all of the time green light, and that anything over 40 would be kind of crazy. I should also point out, there have only been 3 50-plus stolen base seasons by Yankees in the integration era. They're all by Ricky Henderson. They all happened between 1985 and 1988, and they were all 80-plus stolen bases. So, I don't know, man. It's, I think, like, I agree with you that if he had his druthers, he could get to 50. I don't know that he'll be put in the situation to do so unless it really is just way too easy to steal bases now, which it might be.
Right. And I think there's definitely, you know, maybe at last year I would have said in a situation like 40 or something, and I think you do have to give it a little bump. I really do think they don't want to neutralize his speed. Like, if he's going to be hitting leadoff and he's told not to steal bases, I just don't know. Like, I think they would rather not hit him leadoff then. Like, I feel like DJ LeMahieu is a really good leadoff hitter, and I don't think Volpe should be hitting ninth forever if he starts hitting, but at the same time, like, I think Boone and everyone, they want him to use his speed. This is something they're actively looking for. They realize it's a weapon. So I don't think they're going to put him in a position where automatic or suddenly he just can't run. So maybe it's like the middle ground between what I think and what you think, but it will be really interesting because, you know, it is rare for a Yankee, but he's already, you know, doing something that hasn't really been done in Yankees history. He was the first minor league player since Andrew Jones to go 20-50 in the minors. I mean, he's doing things that haven't been done specifically on the base path. So I'd be interested to see, you know, where that goes. I think there's definitely a little eagerness that over the course of a long season might be tempered down, but maybe it doesn't. I it's really interesting. And at the end of the day, it's a dynamic that the Yankees really haven't had that much. I mean, I know they had Gardner and Ellsbury, but I think Volpe can hit at a level that's above them. And he just has the intention. Maybe like peak Jacoby Ellsbury might have been like that, but peak Jacoby Ellsbury was not a Yankee. He was on the Red Sox. We did not get peak Jacoby Ellsbury.
Yeah. It's going to be fun to watch. Maybe I'm still stuck in the smaller bases frame of mind, but yeah, it'll be interesting to see what Volpe ends up doing with that. And I also think that something that might temper his stolen base numbers is, like, eventually he's gonna stop only singling and walking.
Right. Very,
like,
true.
Every time Volpe has been on base to this point in his career in the majors, he has been on first base. Like, all of his base...
He did steal third today, though.
He did,
so.
He did. But, like, all of his base-running adventures have started on first base. So, it'll be interesting. It'll be fun to watch. So, Whipple, do you have anything to say about Saturday's game? I know you weren't able to watch all of it. Basically, you know, people watched it. Clark Schmidt got to a higher pitch count than he is accustomed to getting to and kind of fell apart. And then the Yankees made a couple rallies. And, you know, Clay Holmes wasn't great. Mike King wasn't great. I don't know. It was just, like, kind of a disappointing game. And then Stanton hits, like, 115-mile-an-hour ball into a double play to end the game. Sometimes that happens. You know, they scored 5 runs. Sometimes your pitchers don't show up. I trust Mike King. I trust Clay Holmes. Offense didn't look great, but... you know, 5 hits and 37 at bats isn't gonna do a lot for you. Judge had 3 hits though. Stanton homered, Donaldson homered, and the umpiring was terrible. Which I do think affected the outcome of that game. Or at least the outcome of a number of at-bats in that game.
Yeah, I think my 2 biggest takeaways, other than the umpiring being terrible, are I'm honestly have not been super impressed with Josh Donaldson. And, you know, if you're going to argue pitches that are close that you're taking, check swing, like, I just don't think he's earned the benefit of the doubt to be doing that. And I know he homered, but, like, it's just, I don't know. Like, if he's going to just homer once every few games and then strike out and all his other at-bats, like, I know it's not actually going to be that, but I want to see more from Josh Donaldson. But, like, his mentality is just kind of exhausting, and I feel like he keeps being in the middle of these rallies and not capitalizing. Small sample size, absolutely, for sure, but it's just hard to be super impressed with him so far. I think whenever he's just going to be the most polarizing player on this team. I'm glad for the sake of Giancarlo Stanton that is not Giancarlo Stanton, because he has been that guy so often. But Giancarlo Stanton's like actually good, if you didn't remember. Yeah. And Josh Donaldson, it's debatable if he has anything left. So definitely something to keep an eye on. And I think the other thing is, you know, Clark Schmidt had his moments, but tired. You know, he got tired. He ran out of gas, whatever happened. And I mean, I'm on the record with the Clark Schmidt breakout season, but when you see something like that, it just makes me think about what you said about him turning him into a Mike King, especially if, you know, there are guys in the bullpen who might end up faltering. I mean, we know at least one guy in the bullpen will not be as good as he's projected. That's just the way of baseball. So it's just in the back of your mind with him more than anyone else. So something to keep an eye on. Like, but he had his moments, and that almost makes me think about what you said more. So something to watch.
Yeah, if like Clark Schmidt looked really, really good for those first three innings, and then he got to like 65 pitches or whatever, and it was like, oh crap, Clark Schmidt doesn't really normally throw this many pitches. Making Clark Schmidt into like a deadly multi-inning reliever just gets more and more appealing by the day, man. Like I really like that as an idea. And I understand where you're coming from with Donaldson. Specifically, the strikeout looking against Junis in the fifth inning, like that was a very bad call. That pitch was meaningfully off the plate. Like you can look at the Statcast, you know, live at bat with the pitch locations. It was terrible, and there were a number of such calls in that game, including DJ LeMahieu being called out on strikes in the first plate appearance for the Yankees in that game on a similarly located pitch. It's ridiculous. It's not something that I'm willing to hear that players should have to adjust to. The umpire should get the calls right, and I'm tired of it not happening. And I understand that when it's Josh Donaldson who it happens to, it feels you don't want to give him the benefit of the doubt. But, like, it's the umpires who should not be given the benefit of the doubt. If Josh Donaldson is going to correctly take a pitch, then Josh Donaldson should get credit for doing that. You know, regardless of which hitter does it, they should get credit for doing that. And I'm tired of umpires just getting to be awful and then never be held accountable. It's terrible and I hate it.
Yeah, I mean, Josh Donaldson took some pretty close pitches today and worked a walk. And I think it was the same home plate umpire. So
he did.
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know how I feel about Donaldson.
It would not have been the same home plate umpire.
Oh, I'm rotate. Pretty sure they said it was on the broadcast, but they also probably didn't know. I knew I thought it was weird for a reason. I'm going to blame Michael Kay.
This is checkable. This is checkable.
Probably check is this. Not going to go in my favor, but
Saturday home plate Andy Fletcher. Today home plate Eric Backes. Because that's how it works with umpiring crews.
All right, I'm sorry, everyone. I'm going to go through and comb the audio and find the moment where they said that and come back to you next week.
That's a good idea. Hey, Whipple, before we get to your interview with a Giants fan, can you tell me what the following players have in common? Sebi Zavala, Travis Jankowski, yes. Kerry Carpenter, Jason Vossler, Jake Fraley, and Alec Burleson.
Well, one of them has a really good name, I'll tell you that. Do they all have, I don't know, they all have a higher OPS than some player.
they would all currently be leading the Yankees in WRC plus, because just as we suspected, Aaron Judge's 282 WRC plus through these first three games is just 29th in baseball. Imagine paying a guy $40 million a year just to be 29th in baseball. Abhorrent.
I don't know who this Judge guy is, but he's got to clean up his act pretty quickly. That's not acceptable.
He really does. But everyone knows we just want him to be like Kerry Carpenter or Jason Vossler.
But how about Kyle Higashioka, the last unsung star of today's game, who has obviously turned into a combination of Mike Trout, Mookie Betts, and Ken Griffey Jr. from his time on Team USA. First home run in his first game. It didn't take him. It took him until like June last year. Remember, I think it was off the position player on the Cubs.
It was. I think what happened is Kyle Higashioka heard like a portion of the Gary Sanchez news, basically that he had been signed by a team that was playing in this game. And he thought, oh, crap, they're going to replace me with Gary Sanchez again. I better hit a home run. And then he did. So, I don't know. His next one will come in, like, July or something.
I am excited for the Kyle Higashioka breakout season, even though, you know, people have been predicting better offensive performance for him. But there's real reasons to think. If you go and read about, like, swing adjustments he made, look at the stats. Not that you really want to talk about this, but he hit a lot better at the end of last year. He made meaningful swing adjustments. He spent time with Team USA this year. Look, all I'm saying is that it might be time to get Higgy with it. Might be time for the home run stroke.
Remember when...
And now I'm going to get kicked off this
podcast.
Remember
when IKF went to the same coach that Justin Turner had been seeing and made all his swing adjustments, and then he was really great the next... Oh. Mm.
I will say that also, if a player makes swing adjustments and shows they can hit better, I'm taking that more... I'm looking at it more closely than a player who talks about his swing adjustments, uses them for like three games, and then switches back, which is what happened to IKF last year. And at no time did he hit better. Imagine though, IKF like implements this massive leg kick and just hits like 30 home runs.
That would be the funniest possible timeline.
That's where we are with IKF. This like I've given up. I'm on the seventh stage of I'm on the acceptance stage.
Whipple, are you at all concerned that Garrett Cole's xFIP is 0.25 higher than his FIP, meaning that we can probably expect some regression out of him?
I mean, if he doesn't give up zero runs and strike out 11 batters per game for the rest of the year, I'm going to be very disappointed.
Understandable. All right, Whipple, you interviewed a Giants fan.
I did. So one of my very good friends from college is probably the biggest Giants fan I know, and we got together. We had been talking about this for a while, but I figured with the Aaron Judge scenario or the situation with, you know, the Arson Judge situation, I should say, the opening series and indeed, just his general abhorrence of the Yankees and the fact that I got to interview him right after the Yankees beat the Giants, it was as good a time as any to get him on the pod. We talked about Aaron Judge. We did not talk about Gary Sanchez, and I'm really sorry for that, but his general thoughts on Gary Sanchez were LOL. I don't think Giants fans are too happy with the state of their catching right now. But we looked at some Yankees and Giants players, some players who played for both teams and played a game to see who had the higher WAR. And some of the results would surprise you. I certainly was surprised myself. So, yeah, I had a great time. And, well, let's play it and hear what he has to say about all things San Francisco Giants.
Let's do it.
And we're back, and we have a very special Yankees Files guest. This is someone who I've been talking to about coming on this podcast for 2 years, and now that the Yankees and the Giants are matching up on opening day for the first time in their history, we thought it was the perfect moment to bring on the foremost Giants fan in my life, the guy who probably knows more about the Giants than Dwayne Kuiper himself, Andrew McMillan, one of my college friends, former roommates, and resident Giants fan. Andrew, how are you doing after a pretty eventful opening day?
Doing well. I myself am doing fine, Alec. Thank you for having me on the podcast. But good Lord, that was a disappointment of an opening day from my end.
From my end, it was a very enjoyable opening day. I feel like the listeners of this podcast might agree. But we're, you know, to get your perspective, just, you know, from the Yankees' perspective, Garrett Cole pitched great. Judge homered, Glaber homered, Anthony Volpe debut. It was a great day in the Bronx, a great start to the year. And what did you see from the Giants' perspective? How is Giants fandom taking opening day? You know, what's your general outlook on the game?
Well, it's everything that we've been talking about, at least in Giants land, for the entire offseason. We've got a rotation that is probably going to be one of the best in baseball. I can't think of many others that have either the quality or the depth going into the season that the Giants have. And that's some, you know, obviously some good homegrown talent in the face of Logan Webb, but then also some pretty shrewd offseason acquisitions with Ross Stripling, Sean Manaea, big hopes for bounce back campaigns from them. But then just more of the same from 2022 with just a complete lack of any kind of offensive firepower. The old keep getting older, the people regressing to the mean regress even harder to the mean. And it just, it shows up with a big fat goose egg on the opening day scoreline. So it's never not painful to be shut out. And especially with just that kind of whimper to start the 2023 season doesn't exactly instill you with confidence. But at the same time, we were kind of expecting this with not a whole lot of reinforcements arriving during the offseason for the offensive side of things.
Yeah, I mean, I think you guys probably have the pitching advantage in the next two games. But offensively, I would say the Yankees do have an advantage. And, you know, we're going to talk a little bit about the offseason from an offensive perspective from the Giants. But first, we need your backstory. I mean, I know that when I met you, it was right before the 2014 wildcard game and before the third of the Giants' three miracle runs in 2010, 2012, 2014. I mean, just, you know, such out of nowhere championship runs. You know, I don't think they were the favorites in any of the years, but they had the same core and they just found a way to get it done in October. I'm sure Yankees fans wish they had some of the Giants magic. But what's your origin story? What's your, you know, how did you become a Giants fan? And what are some of the experiences you've enjoyed over the years?
We've been in my household, in my family's household, Giants fans since, God, probably the late 80s at this point. My dad, with his hour-long commutes from Sunnyvale to the city, would listen to Hank Greenwald on the radio, and that's when he really fell in love with the Giants and the folks over here. But for me, it wasn't Hank Greenwald. It was Dwayne Kuiper and Mike Kruko, also known as the best broadcasting duo in the game. And I think I have some more support from non-Giants fans for that, too. But it was all, the game was always on either the TV or the radio, and Little League baseball was my favorite time of year. So I was always a baseball fan to play because I happened to be pretty okay for Little League. Better than average, I think, is probably the best way to say. I'm not out there slinging 98 mile an hour heat the way some other people younger than me are, like Logan Webb. But it's always just been a significant part of my life. My favorite thing to do was to go to Giants games and get garlic fries and just be at the ballpark and just sort of see all the stuff that I could do on the Little League diamond being played out on the big stage, which of course was helped out with the single greatest offensive player of all time, Barry Bonds, being a fixture of San Francisco baseball right during my formative years. So Bonds, the 73 home run season, the chase for 715, 755, and then just to be the all-time home run king were very fundamental experiences to me as a kid growing up. So, and then on top of that, there was the rivalry. Like, I'm sure you as a Yankees fan had a lot, can draw a lot of emotional sort of formulation, and just lots of your identity growing up was probably around hating the Red Sox a lot. Same went for me for hating the Dodgers. And the thing that gets me going in sports more than anything else is a good rivalry. I can get on board with any sport, anytime, anywhere, anything, so long as there's a good rivalry. So Duke, UNC, I'm there for it. Red Sox, Yankees, I'm there for it. What about Manchester United, Liverpool? I'm there for it. So like, it doesn't matter the sport. I love rivalries. So, and then on top of that, in more recent years, just an insanely good writing quality from the baseball journalists covering them, with Grant Brisby National Treasure Grant Brisby has really done a lot to keep me sort of close to the team that I loved growing up, even though I've been living much further afield than the Bay Area. So it's always been just a big part of who I am as a person. I love baseball, I love the Giants, and love talking mad trash about things, especially after the dynasty years of the early 2010s, which just solidified my lifetime status as a Giants fan.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because, you know, your remark to me was always that I was a Yankees fan who won all the time, 27 rings, but you've seen your team win a lot more, I think, maybe not as many years in total, but more championships for sure. So I always thought that was funny. And I think you're right with the, you know, Grant Brisby, probably one of the best writers, funniest writers, you know, somebody that I follow despite not really being a Giants fan. And I think that does a lot for bringing a team into the national profile. I mean, I think the Yankees are lucky to have a lot of good writers covering them, but it's New York. I mean, you're just always going to have a lot of people starting off as Yankees fans moving into the business. I think Grant Brisby is just taken the Giants to probably a level of national prominence. I mean, definitely prominent on my Twitter feed when I was seeing his jokes. And yeah, I think it's really cool in baseball how like regional aspects can get promoted to a national level. Just based on the guys who are, you know, out there doing the work covering them. So Bonds, Brisby, Posey. I mean, the other Giants memory, I mean, one I have from living with you was the 2021 year, you know, probably the most improbable baseball year we've all seen.
No doubt. That's just the sort of stuff that dreams are made of, because Grant Brisby every year does a worst case, best case, and most likely scenario series of articles for his predictions of the year. And looking back at that 2021 best case scenario for the Giants, it's eerie. It's just, it's like the twilight zone of just like, how did he manage to get that exact thing about, you know, the emergence of Yaz or the rotation just, you know, or turning into form, or late night Lamont coming out of the woodwork. So that was probably the most fun I've had since the 2014 World Series run being a Giants fan.
Yeah, I think my favorite Grant Brisby moment was when he predicted like 2 weeks before the pandemic that the Giants were going to win like 25 games and the season would get canceled. And that's what happened. They're like, next time they're like, you're not allowed to do predictions anymore. Your power is too strong. So
easily the best Grant Brisby prediction was when every single other SB Nation writer did their predictions for the 2012 World Series and predicted the Tigers in 5, Tigers in 6. And Grant Brisby said, screw all of you, Giants in 4. Barry Zito throws 18 scoreless innings, and he was right. He was right.
Yeah, no, it's the Giants have had some moments for sure. And, you know, those are more positive moments. But I think Yankees and Giants fans were uniquely connected this offseason through a series of events that really had Yankees fans' hearts, you know, hearts stopped at a certain point in time from a certain tweet by a Mr. John Heyman. And I've talked about with Will on this pod, and definitely, again, a more positive take. But we haven't had a chance to really talk and see how, you know, the other side is feeling. So I have to ask you, how has the Aaron Judge saga and the Carlos Correa subsequent saga, how did that impact your winter? What's your overall take on whether, you know, avoiding the Judge deal was good or bad? And then, you know, the Correa mishap, did that end up helping the Giants by avoiding those deals? Or was the subsequent alternative of Michael Conforto, Mitch Haniger, just not sufficient to put them in a good position to contend this year?
Long live Aaron Judge. That's what I'll say first.
Somebody showed up to Yankee Stadium wearing an Aaron Judge jersey and a Giants jersey. That was a little cruel.
I respect that, though. That's some good content. It was a Giants jersey with Aaron Judge written on it.
Yes.
Okay. That's good. That's good content. I appreciate the, well, and that's something we've talked about before when it comes to the different media markets that are San Francisco and New York, which we can get into later, but it hurts. It of course it hurts. It can't be anything besides hurting, because, and especially with Judge being from California, not just California, but like not too far away from San Francisco levels of California, grew up, I think, you know, rooting for the Giants. Like there's like stories of like him and Jock Peterson both being at the 2010 World Series parade or something crazy like that, you know, with all these connections to the hometown team and Brigham Home. And, you know, he had all this amazing success in the toughest baseball market in the country. And now we just want to give him a hero's welcome and have him be the face of this franchise that's been crying out for something ever since Buster Posey, you know, took his victory lap and is, you know, ridden off into the sunset to join the ownership group, which is its own level of 4D chess, which I have to applaud. And especially because of those 10 minutes, that's the worst part. It's not just like Arson Judge is close to going to the Giants, or I'm hearing things about movement going towards San Francisco. It was, he's on the Giants. We got him. We snookered him away from the Yankees, and he is now ours, except it wasn't true. And it was just that. And because I was in Europe at the time, so this was all playing out, not just at 2 a.m, but like during my work day. So I was just like, I was just roller coaster of emotions up and down the whole time. But at the end of the day, it makes sense. Like when you go up through the Yankee system and become as successful and as big of a character as Judge is with the Judge's court and the chase for 62 and all this other stuff going on, it kind of reminded me of the Pablo Sandoval sort of saga of like you turn into this beloved fan favorite, the Kung Fu Panda, and then you just leave. And things went so badly for him in Boston. I can't help but imagine that that sort of calculus was going on through Judge's mind, especially if he likes New York. Like he's got that fun sort of series of interviews where went incognito and, you know, was asking people about what they thought of Aaron Judge without them knowing it was Aaron Judge. So I think he's really, it's like you dance with the devil, you know, where he likes the Red Sox rivalry. He likes being in the American League. He likes, you know, the short porch in right field, whatever it is that actually like, you know, connects him to the Yankees and the Bronx. That was never going to, the only thing that was going to drive him away is if the Yankees said, we'll give you 9 years, but 34 million or 340 million. And the Giants said 9 years, 360. That's the sort of thing that you say, okay, well, they literally value me more, so I'm going to go where I'm appreciated. But the Yankees were going to match whatever the Giants had to offer. And at that point, there's no tearing him away from that. So it hurt, but I get it. I do understand.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like the Padres might have tried to undercut both of them at the last minute. So, you know, I think that might have been the worst case scenario for both Giants and Yankees fans.
Absolutely. Well, you know, with all the stuff about like Scherzer going to the Dodgers, but he was this close to the Padres, like, you know, the Padres haven't won anything recently. So I kind of feel for them. They're like the underachieving little brother in the National League West.
But I think the thing with Judge was like, you actually didn't know. Like, I agree with you. In retrospect, it all seems so obvious, but he played it so close to the chest, like that I was running around being like, what does this mean? What does this mean? I tip your cap to him because he played it perfectly to get the money that he deserved, but you genuinely didn't know. I mean, when that tweet came out, there was, you know, there wasn't enough basis in anything else. Yankees fans, you know, just kind of saw it and were like, well, shit, like that's it. So, you know, it was such a weird time, a weird day, and credit to Judge at the end, he got paid. And I know you're of the mindset, you know, you like to see the guys get paid.
100%. And so, and which is why I don't mind him using the Giants as leverage. Like, you know, play the Steinbrenners off of Greg Johnson. It's not my money. make it your money, Judge. Like, you know, you go get that bag. But it's such an interesting comparison to the Correa sort of turn of events, because as you said, with Judge, it was, you know, poker. He was not revealing anything. It was late night calls with the Steinbrenners that, you know, actually got him back to go to New York, because I think there was a big nostalgic sort of part of him inside that wanted to go back to California and play for his hometown team. But whereas with Correa, there was no such loyalty to any one team, especially after Houston sort of, you know, brushed him off the way that they did in 2020 or whenever it was that he left. And then, you know, had to go to, it landed with Minnesota to, you know, have a little bit of a pillow contract. And it was, he's approaching it from such a mercenary kind of perspective, which again, total respect for, because I'm all about getting money from the owners to the players. Like, do what you need to do. And in the case of Judge, he was able to parlay the fan connection and the intimate closeness that he has with New York. Correa is just the best shortstop in baseball right now. So you go get the highest bidder. And for the longest time, it was the Giants. It was, everything was going exactly right until that kind of familiar feeling of, oh, shit. Like, it wasn't just like, obviously, there was the delayed press conference, but then it was just that one tweet or that one press release that said, we're actually not moving on from this. And the Mets are swooping in. That was the moment. That was the Arson Judge moment, was when at 3 a.m, I think Ken Rosenthal was like, oh yeah, the Mets are signing him for, you know, $5 million or $35 million less than the Giants were. That one hurt. That one hurt even more than the Judge thing. Cause I was kind of ready for that. You know, it was a little bit of a bait and switch kind of thing with Aaron Judge, but Correa going to the Mets was real. It was the real gut punch of like, okay, that we had him and now we don't. Like, it, cause it was a moment. It was a long moment when we had Correa. So I'm curious, like, what was, you know, your sort of, obviously you were just, you know, riding your high of retaining Judge, but like the chaos was just unlike anything anybody I think had experienced, because this is one of the first times that like pending physical actually meant something. It actually led to some kind of significant outcome. Well, and so that's why this is the thing I'm most frustrated about. And this is, I think, a good transition into sort of talking about GM philosophies or how the teams are run, because there's so many doomsayers, just so many just doomers out there saying like, fire Farhan, he's doing all this crap that's not good, he's dumpster diving, it's roster churn, we're not as good as the Dodgers, we're not spending like the Padres, it's impossible. And I'm just over here sitting over here thinking, what was all this past offseason about? The Giants finally started throwing their weight around the way that they're supposed to, because we can stand up to the Yankees. We can stand up to the Dodgers. We can actually go out there and be the highest bidder, even though we haven't been acting that way since we signed Barry Bonds for $43 million in the early 90s. So it was a really great show of faith, finally, saying like, look, we can afford this because we're printing money at this point. We can do whatever we want. But then you had the problem of trying to tear away the hero of the baseball's biggest media market in the country, and then an ankle made out of Legos, which flummoxed not one but two sets of medical experts, and that's just the sort of fluke thing that'll happen sometimes. Baseball is a fluky sport that makes you sometimes laugh, and I'm going to point to a Grant Brisby tweet really quickly that was sent on December 7th, 2022. Just promise me that you'll find it funny when Aaron Judge hits a 500-foot homer on the first pitch of the 2023 Giants season. That's all I ask. And the caveat is that he's hitting second in the order, not first, as he was in the later months of the last year. So fine, it was the sixth pitch of the 2023 Giants season, but that's just the kind of thing. Like, yeah, you could see that coming from him as soon as the whole Aaron Judge thing happened. It's like, yeah, that's gonna happen. It's gonna sting and it's gonna happen.
Yeah, well, you know, at the risk of preventing you from jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge when talking about this, I mean, you know, there are a lot of free agents on the market that you guys are positioned to get, but like you said, eventually you have to get it done. I hope for your guys' sake that you do, but we also, you know, we have a little surprise game to bring you out of your misery and to talk a little bit about Yankees and Giants shared history. So I didn't tell you exactly what we're doing, but a few guys have played for both the Yankees and Giants. I learned only four players who have only played for both the Yankees and Giants, including one, Tyro Estrada, and the history of and I, for purposes of the game, I limited it to San Francisco Giants. I took New York Giants out. Just wanted to focus mostly on guys that we had both watched to make this a little more applicable. But we have 10 players in front of me, and the object of the game, you're going to guess, for which team did they have more wins above replacement? I use Baseball Reference.
Okay.
So I have 10 guys. Some are more obvious than others. We're going to see how many of these 10 you can get. And they're all guys who played for both the Yankees and Giants. There's one or two who are older, but most of them are newer. So I think you'll know all of the names. So are you ready to put your skills to the test?
I am nervous, but yeah, let's do it.
All right. We're going to start off with an easy one. We have Randy Winn.
Oh God, you say easy, and I didn't know he played for the Yankees. Good Lord. But given his status as a commentator for the pre and post game shows for the Giants, that speaks to a longer lasting connection with the Bay Area. So I'm going to go with the Giants for Randy Winn.
Yes, yeah, you are correct. Randy Winn played one, like, 2/3 of a season in 2010 with the Yankees, had negative 0.7 WAR and 13.4 WAR with the Giants. So
hilarious.
I mean, obviously the pre and post game show connection, but you know, there are players like Cameron Maybin was doing TV for the Yankees. He played one season for them. So, you know, it's not, Randy Winn could be on the YES Network. It's possible.
You never know. You never know.
All right. Next Randy on our list, another guy named Randy. We have Randy Johnson.
Randy Johnson. Well, see, this is an interesting one because obviously the iconic non-baseball baseball fan is going to remember him as a Diamondback, but the ones in more in the know know he's the Mariners. He was the force behind the late 90s, mid to late 90s resurgence of the Mariners. And knowing that he got his 300th win with the Giants really speaks to him being in the twilight of his career. And I'm pretty sure that the Yankees scooped him up before that. So I am going to go with the Yankees on this one.
You are correct. 2 for 2. Yankees, he had 7.5 WAR over 2 years, although not entirely successful, given the way he ended his tenure there was not, he was not a big fan of the media. I think he punched a cameraman one time, but oops. Giants only 0.3 WAR, like you said, last year of his career. All right, so 2 for 2. Now we have an older player. We have Don Larsen.
Don Larsen. He played for the Giants?
Good he did. Grief.
So Larsen, 1956 World Series. Am I getting my Yankees history in order? Okay. So that's the perfect game. And he was pretty young when that happened, right? If I remember him talking about, like, was he tripping on something when he threw that perfect game?
No, was that a different story? I think that was Doc Ellis, but he was also young. He's not no tripping.
Right. That was the LSD thing. All right, Don Larsen. I always think of him as a Yankee, so I got to go with the Yankees on this.
Yep. He is 4.6 WAR for the Yankees, 3.7 for the Giants. So
wow. How many seasons was he with the Giants?
Like 3 years or something. Huh. But more for the Yankees, but it's not as much as you think. These are going to start to get a little bit harder. So
okay.
All right, next one. A player we watched on opening day, Wandy Peralta.
Wandy Vision. Well, think about Wandy is that he was a bit of a journeyman when he arrived with the Giants, wasn't he? Like, these aren't the only two teams he's played for, and he's got to be like 33, 34 at this point. And knowing just how critical he's become to the Yankees bullpen, which is not to say like he's a Mariano Rivera level or anything just yet, but he's an important setup man. I'd actually have to go with the Yankees on this one because the trade happened with Mike Tauchman. We talked about, you know, Tauchman saving the home run last year and like having equal levels of contributions to our respective teams in 2021, not last year. But I think Wandy's had some good long usage. We're 2023. This is almost 2 years out from the trade, so I'll go with the Yankees on this one.
Yeah, I think if you had come on last year, we probably just spent half an hour talking about just the Wandy Tauchman trade because that's kind of I think that was like our topic of conversation for a little while. You are correct. Wandy has 2 WAR as a Yankee. I think he's pitched a little bit longer with the Giants, but not as effective, just 0.4 WAR. So you're 4 for 4. Now we're going to move on to another reliever, Mark Melancon.
When was Mark Melancon on the Yankees? Like
Mark Melancon came up with the Yankees, actually.
No kidding. Wow. Yeah.
He's been around, but he started with the Yankees.
I always think of him in his breakout seasons with the Pirates. That's what I remember him from.
He was in a trade, and I think the Pirates are like his third team.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. Okay. Well, the thing about Melancon, my connection with him was that he was one of those free agents. You know how you think like, oh, the Yankees or the Giants should sign this person before the offseason starts, and then it happens. It's like, and you feel like the greatest armchair GM of all time. He was one of those guys, and it seemed like, I think, a pretty good deal at the time. And then he was terrible in his first season with the Giants. It was one of those like big, bad mistakes of the old regime before Farhan had come in. So, but then he got better. So I'm actually going to go with the Giants on this one. I'll change tack and say Melancon was better with the Giants than the Yankees.
Yeah, 5 for 5. Melancon had 0.1 WAR with the Yankees, and he spent his first two seasons, but was also traded pretty young in the Lance Berkman deal in 2010. So really didn't break out until after he left the Yankees. I think that's one of the, I mean, not that he was the one that got away, but I think the Yankees would like to have a do-over on that one.
Where did he go after the Yankees?
Astros. And then I think ended up with the Pirates.
Interesting.
All right. Moving on to our sixth player, Carlos Beltran.
Beltran. Ah, the 2011 season. What could have been? Seriously, that was an absolutely nutty second half. Like, I'm not even upset that we gave away Zach Wheeler for that second half that Carlos Beltran put up for us, which was obviously, you know, like trying to, you know, connect, like try to hold things together with duct tape and a prayer after, you know, the Buster Posey incident. But golly, he went on a tear that year. So Beltran, the question is, did he have more than one season with the Yankees? Because if he did, I'd be inclined to say then. And I'm actually going to say yes. I feel like he was with the Yankees a little bit longer, and just as a result of that, had more work. So I'll say Yankees for Beltran.
Yep. Yeah, Beltran was on the Yankees for 2.5 years, had 2.8 WAR, but in his half season with the Giants, had 1.2 WAR. So, like, it's not for half a season.
He went on a tear. Like, there was a moment where we're just like, do we really need Posey for this, like, stretch run? Like, golly, it was insane.
All right, player number 7, George Kontos.
Oh, there's a name I haven't heard in a while. I was the biggest George Kontos apologist in my household. My dad hated him. Could not. Well, and it wasn't about like, you know, didn't hate him like a Hunter Strickland kind of hate where he's an actual dingleberry. But, you know, just kind of like he was just like, oh, God, here we go. We're going to, you know, lose. And I was like, no, George Kontos, I believe. And he pitched for the Yankees after the Giants. But I don't think he was as effective. I don't think this is a Wandy Peralta situation. So I'll go with the Giants for George Kontos.
Yeah, George Kontos actually came up with the Yankees and then was traded for Chris Stewart.
Wow, that was how we got
that. Was a Yankees-Giants trade from the past. And you guys got him, and definitely a trade I think you won. Because he had 3.5 WAR with you guys. Only 0.2 with us. I think he came back in 2018, but was not that good. So
okay, so he did pitch for the Yankees after. That's what I was thinking of. Interesting.
All right. We're down to our final three here. Oh, so the next one, Andrew McCutchen.
McCutchen. Oh, gosh. So we – oh, God, the Brian Johnson trade, and they're rest in pieces for us because – we did not need McCutchen, and we could desperately, desperately use Brian Johnson's athleticism at the moment. McCutchen, I believe, went to the Yankees after the Giants, which means he would have been older, but had maybe a bit of a career resurgence. Oh, God, he was so much fun to watch. As sad as I am that we lost Brian Johnson, I was really happy to get to watch McCutchen. So I am going to go with the Yankees for this one, actually. I think he did better in the Bronx.
This first misstep.
And oh, no.
So what happened, you were on the right track. He had one season with the Giants, and you guys traded him to us on August 31st. So he had 1 month with the Yankees. And it was a really good month. And the WAR here is actually pretty similar. So 1.6 with the Giants, 0.9 with the Yankees. But that's 5 months to 1 month. So your intuition was right. It just wasn't as long as you were thinking. And he left after that for the Phillies.
Who else was in that trade?
It was a August 31st trade. I think it was like for peanuts, you know, nobody of significance.
Must have been.
All right. So you have two left. You're 7 for 8. The second to last player is Melky Cabrera.
Melky Cabrera, the milkman. Oh, God, the milkman delivers. That was a gut punch in the middle of that 2012 season when he got busted for PEDs. Cause he was all-star. He was like player of the month. He was like, I think it was like him, Posey, and maybe like Goldschmidt were like the three people in the topic for MVP that year. And then, yeah, he was just not in baseball. But the question is, when did he play for the Yankees? Because he was only with the Giants for half a season, if memory serves. We signed him in that offseason, and they got busted for PEDs in like August or something of that year. And then if he was with the Yankees for any more amount of time, I'm going to say the Yankees, actually, because I only remember him being around for that half a season.
So you are correct. He actually came up with the Yankees. Melky Cabrera was the center fielder for the 2009 World Champion Yankees, played for them for 4 years, was traded away. And yet, the funny part of this is, 5.7 career WAR in like 4 or 5 seasons as a Yankee, in one half season as a Giant, 4.8 WAR. So
insane. I forgot how good he was. Good
the
Lord.
Only time I went to AT&T Park was that summer, the day before he got suspended, and he was playing. The milkmaids were out. It was a Melky Cabrera love fest. I woke up next morning, my uncle handed me the paper, Melky Cabrera suspended. Like, that was it. So I went to his last game as a Giant.
Wow.
And I remember that moment, like, my uncle was devastated.
I mean, I was devastated too, but then, you know, we made up for it with our, which I would like to say, you say miraculous runs. The 2012 team was like the one which, like, with, you know, rock solid rotation, MVP Posey going off, you know, Brandon Belt, Crawford coming into their own. I mean, yes, we did come very close to elimination more than once, but then the you know, the sweep of the Tigers happened. So
all right, last player, Eduardo Nunez.
Wow, that's a name I haven't heard in a while. He was like a utility infielder, right? Kind of like a higher Adrianza kind of situation where it was defense first and kind of speedy. Eduardo Nunez, because he was somebody we picked up in a trade from the Yankees, wasn't he? Is that, can you reveal that much? Came up with the Yankees and then went to the Giants.
Yeah.
This was another trade. So wasn't very good at either stop though, if memory serves. Unfortunately, the perceptions, the memories that I have aren't as strong. So I am going to go with the Giants on this one because I think he was around for longer.
So you are correct. He was not around for longer, but he had negative 1.5 WAR as a Yankee, 1.3 WAR as a Giant. He had a negative 1.3 WAR in 2013 alone. Eduardo Nunez will be remembered by Yankees fans for losing his helmet whenever he ran and playing god awful defense. So I will give you like 9.5 because your intuition on McCutcheon was right, even though you didn't get the team. But a very successful showing. I think I was able to teach you a few, you know, Giants you didn't realize they'd come up as Yankees.
You did. That's a cool thing because this is something really interesting about, I think, the player development for both the Yankees and the Giants, especially with Brian Sabian rejoining the Yankees front office just a few months ago. People don't realize that he was actually the guy responsible for not one, but two insanely good waves of talent that arrived in the major leagues. First, the Yankees in the late 90s, which powered the World Series runs back then. But then in the late 2000s, that's what powered the dynasties. It was Matt Cain. It was Tim Lincecum. It was Brandon Belt. It was Brandon Crawford. It was Buster Posey. Like, that was all orchestrated by Sabian. And with the new administration that we have going on, they weren't giving Sabian quite as much like respect as I think he was hoping for. So that's why I think that's a big part of why he returned to his old stomping grounds. So if there's one, you know, there's one part of me that's like, oh, would be okay with the Yankees being successful, it's hoping Brian Sabian hits on another few home runs as far as prospects go.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on, because hearing you wish the Yankees success is probably as good as I'm going to get from you. But this has been a pleasure. And, you know, I'm so glad we got to do this. And you know what? If the Yankees and the Giants play in a significant postseason series in the future, we'll do this again because, who else am I going to have on who knows about the Giants?
Bet on it. I'm there for it 110%.
All right. Thanks, AMAC. We're going to kick it back to Will and myself to close out the rest of the pod.
Thanks, Alec.
All right, we are back. Whipple, great interview. Although I do have to question one thing, which is I have a text message that I'm looking at from you right now that says, quote, "I will ask him his thoughts about Gary." And as you mentioned, you didn't do that. So gonna have to ask you why.
You know, just out of respect for Gary and respect for, you know, the deified, is that a word? The godlike tones in which we refer to him in his 2016, 2017, 2019 season. I don't think we allow disparaging words about Gary Sanchez on this pod. So out of respect for that, I decided, you know, it's not good for the listeners to hear such garbage. Because I don't think anything good would have come from it. And if somebody wants to believe that Joey Bart is a better catching option, if Roberto Perez is a better catching option than Gary Sanchez, that should not disgrace the hallowed halls of Yankees Files. That was as kiss up as an answer as I could give to you.
Yeah, it was a good try. Whipple, Carlos Rodon is hurt. Luis Severino is hurt. Tommy Canely is hurt. Harrison Bader is hurt. Isaiah Kiner-Falefa just started game 3 of the season in center field for the New York Yankees, a team that claims to have championship aspirations. And I'm interested in how all of that is going to affect your confidence in this team out of 10 following their 2-1 opening series of the season against the Giants, the +9 run differential. What do you got for me?
We were at 9, and I don't think we've seen enough to go up yet. I think we've only seen 3 games. They've been 3 really good games, and I think there's a few things that could have happened that would made us go down. You know, maybe the whole lineup fails to score a run. You know, every guy gets hurt. Like, there's not much early in the season that can really knock your confidence, but I think a 9 is a very optimistic score. Like, I feel very good about giving them a 9. And after 3 games, I think that's where you got to stand. Like, some guys were disappointing, but, you know, I'd rather have the Johnny Britos of the world pitching like they are, because I have trust that Mike King will figure it out. But, man, Johnny Brito's been great. Yep. You know, Volpe's look good. Judge and Stanton are back. If there's one thing I want for this season, it's the return of the Judge-Stanton world-beating dynamic. And we saw a lot of it this weekend. So I hope that, you know, we've seen enough baseball in the next week to go up. But at the same time, like, the early season, we know that, you know, it doesn't matter as much as people might think it does. But I feel like a 9, given the injuries and just given the generally positive play this weekend, I'm feeling a 9 for this team, and definitely a lot of room to go up, because this team showed some things this weekend that if they keep trending that way, if Gerrit Cole keeps pitching like he did, if Judge and Stanton are actually going to both have MVP years at the same time, I'd be sorry for the rest of the league.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd feel sorry for the baseballs. So the Yankees played well against a solid team in this first series of the year. We saw, as you said, good performances from the guys from whom we'd expect good performances. We saw some reasons to be optimistic from the kids. And, you know, the things that might give us pause, we can be reasonably confident we'll get figured out. So with that, I'm going to stay at a 9 as well. The Yankees host the Phillies for 3 games starting on Monday, and then go down to Baltimore on Thursday, off day Friday, and then wrap up that 3-game series over the weekend. We will be back next weekend with another episode to recap the week that was. People can follow us at YankeesFiles.com, where we put up all our written content. They can follow us on Twitter, where we're at YankeesFiles. They can also get the podcast wherever they get their podcasts. We hope that you'll rate, review, and subscribe, but only if you like the podcast. If you don't like the podcast, just subscribe, play it on silent, boost up our listener numbers. You know, it's all good for us. And Whipple, I'll throw it to you for any parting shots before we wrap up here.
So this is a Yankees podcast. We love the Yankees. We talk about the Yankees, but I think the biggest game of the week will not be a Yankees game. The biggest game of the week is tomorrow night. Go UConn Huskies. Go get your 5th championship and really just complete one of the most dominant NCAA tournament runs I think we have ever seen from this team, from any team, and make Bill Murray, make him proud.
The UConn Huskies are the best team in college basketball by metrics such as KenPom's adjusted efficiency margin. They are in the midst of one of the most dominant tournament runs that we've seen, potentially the most dominant since 2009 North Carolina. They ultimately finished off with the national championship. They are the only team in all of college basketball to be ranked in the top 10 in both adjusted offense and adjusted defense on KenPom. And they are 7.5-point favorites against San Diego State, which is probably too many points, on Monday night. Whipple, I believe the last time that UConn played, oh no, this isn't true. We watched the UConn Arizona game. We did not watch the UConn San Diego State game. But we have a history of watching NCAA tournament games together and UConn succeeding in them. We will not be watching this national championship game together, but go Huskies anyway. I'm very excited for the game tomorrow. I'm very nervous about the game tomorrow. And if there's anyone out there who thinks that the UConn men's basketball program is not a blue blood program or has any thoughts about them achieving less than some other teams, you're probably wrong. They're already the most successful team of the last quarter century, and winning a national championship tomorrow would simply further cement that. Also, Dan Hurley has appeared in as many championship games in the last 20 years as Tom Izzo. So if there are any like Michigan State fans who listen to this podcast, go away. I don't even want you here. With that, at Yankees Files on Twitter,
UConn Files,
Huskies Files, at Yankees Files on Twitter, YankeesFiles.com, podcast wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back to do this again next week. And until then, let's go Yankees.